I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We start today with those two new studies published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, the first studies to quantify the risk of CAT scans, and they conclude CAT scans may cause cancer. The studies were conducted by the University of California, San Francisco, and the National Cancer Institute. They concluded that CAT scans may be responsible for about 2% of all new cancer cases. Other findings, women are more vulnerable because of thinner tissue, and there are vast irregularities in the level of radiation. Well, the head of the American College of Radiation agrees. He applauds hospitals which require doctors to justify high-dose scans, and his group is developing machines with alarms that will sound at dangerous doses. But meanwhile, let's learn about the studies. Dr. Donald Frush is chair of the American College of Radiology Pediatric Commission and a radiologist. Dr. Frush, what exactly is a CAT scan? How does it compare to X-rays?
A CAT scan uses X-rays, but it's a more sophisticated examination. It requires more radiation to form the detailed pictures, and it may be the equivalent of approximately 50 to several hundred X-ray examinations.
And CAT scan CT stands for what?
CT stands for computed tomography. It's also known as a CAT scan for computed assisted tomography.
And why would someone need one? What do you think that it does well?
CT shows us virtually any part of the body, from the brain down to the extremities. It's very helpful in the setting of trauma to look for injury inside the head that may not be evident on physical examination. It's very good at detecting cancer and for the follow-up and surveillance of cancer. It's used frequently in abdominal conditions, including appendicitis, and for looking at pulmonary thromboembolism or blood clots to the lungs.
And we understand it might cause cancer through the radiation because a CAT scan might cause mutation in DNA. And here's where some of the troubling aspects of the studies come. You say CAT scan might be 50, maybe 100 times the effect of a chest X-ray. But the team at UC San Francisco found that sometimes scanners were giving more than 440 times a conventional X-ray. And what they're saying is the sheer large number of CAT scans per year, 23 times the number in 1980, might produce a sharp increase in cancers and deaths. But is it also perhaps being used when it doesn't have to be?
Well, that's always a concern with any laboratory study or imaging test, is that we need to be sure that CT examinations are performed only when they're indicated. And that is a consideration that's between a physician and the patient directly.
Well, let's get to some of these scary and startling statistics. We understand, for instance, that the highest doses in CAT scans are routinely used for coronary angiography. This is imaging to look at the heart, to look for blockage. The Los Angeles Times writes that according to the UC San Francisco report, one in 270 women and one in 600 men who receive one of these high-dose CAT scans, just one at the age of 40, might be at risk to develop cancer as a result. That's a pretty startling conclusion.
There are some considerations that are there. And first of all, that is at a relatively high dose.
Right.
It also is an estimate. So there are other individuals that feel the risk is not that high, or there may be no risk at all. In addition, you have to understand what the benefit, too, is. And if you're talking about looking at a coronary artery with a CT examination versus putting a catheter directly in it and the attendant risks of that kind of procedure, if the CT examination can answer the question about a blocked artery, about potential treatment, whether it's surgery or not, then the CT examination is very helpful.
Well, but what are you and other radiologists going to do as a result of these tests? It's recommended that consumers keep a record of their CAT scans so that they really have a handle on how many they're having, and that they, for instance, may ask for an MRI as a substitute at times. MRIs, do they have lower radiation?
MRIs do not use ionizing radiation like CT examinations, so there's not the same risk of cancer as with CT examinations.
Mm-hmm.
Your points are a good one. What consumers, what the patients, what the families need to do is to make sure that the study is indicated. Do I need a CT examination or not? And these are questions that can be asked of the physician. Is another study appropriate? would an ultrasound be helpful to answer this question, or an MRI examination?
Dr. Donald Frush, chair of the American College of Radiology Pediatric Commission and a radiologist at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Frush, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Reporter Andrew Ross Sorkin, writing in the New York Times, says yesterday's no-show of several top bank executives at that much-ballyhooed White House meeting spoke volumes about how the balance of power between Wall Street and Washington has shifted again back to Wall Street. True, he says, the bank leaders seemed upset that inclement weather kept them away, but if they really wanted to be there, couldn't they have taken the train? And he notes further a sign of the shift in power. Both Citigroup and Wells Fargo announced they will pay back bailout money. So the leverage Washington had over the industry seems to be eroding. But our next guest says banks paying back bailout money is a direct result of leveraging. Ken Feinberg is President Obama's pay czar. He was appointed last summer after AIG, one of the bailed out companies, announced millions of dollars in bonuses for employees in the very unit that nearly took the company down. Ken Feinberg recently announced compensation restrictions for companies receiving bailout money. Let's catch up with him today. Ken Feinberg, pay czar, joins us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I just want to get to that point I mentioned first. You've said that the number one purpose of limiting executive pay is to get companies to pay back their bailout money and get themselves out from under government supervision. You know, really, we thought the number one reason might be to get the industry, you know, more in line with the real world and get them away from risky pay structures that reward failure.
I think that that is also a goal. I think the number one goal, clearly, was to get the taxpayers their money back. And at least as to those two banks where I had statutory jurisdiction, Bank of America and Citigroup, that money has been returned. Now, that's not to say that the prescriptions that I used in establishing executive compensation should be ignored. I'm pleased to see early steps by Goldman to adopt some of those prescriptions that I've used within my jurisdiction. But clearly, the primary goal was to get the taxpayers their money back.
Well, let's address Goldman Sachs. You've praised them for what they've done recently, and they took a beating in the press. I'm thinking specifically of Matt Taibbi's Rolling Stone article about Goldman Sachs' role in the financial meltdown. What did they do recently that you have applauded?
They adopted my ruling and stated that there would be zero cash bonuses paid to their employees and high-ranking officials this year, and that instead, in lieu of a cash bonus, these high-ranking officials would receive stock that would not be redeemable for 5 years, so that these officials have a vested stake in the future of the company.
And most important, that stock can be retracted.
That is correct. So, as the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Neil Wolin, pointed out last week, it is a small step, but it is a recognition that some of my prescriptions and rules will be adopted in whole or in part by Wall Street. And I think that is a good sign.
We should say under the Goldman Sachs ruling, some of the stock awarded to some of these high executives that they have to hold on to for 5 years can be taken back if the executive down the road does something that hurts the firm. And this seemed to be the problem with a lot of the company policies in the past, that somebody could do something, get the stock, get the bonuses, and then very shortly after, what they did could turn out to be disastrous, but it wouldn't matter because they'd already been paid.
That's correct. You remember now, under the rulings that I have used, there are no cash guarantees. There are no guarantees of any type in compensation other than reduced base cash salary. Everything else is prospective, tied to performance metrics, can be clawed back for excessive risk. These are steps, I think, that are important precedents that hopefully will be used by companies that are not subject to my mandatory jurisdiction.
See, that the word hopefully there, Ken Feinberg, is the thing that people worry about. Because we're already seeing companies scrambling to, as you say, pay back the bailout money so that they're not under different restrictions, including compensation restrictions. Do you have hope that they will follow some of your recommendations.
Yes, but there's more than hope. Don't forget, even though I've lost my mandatory jurisdiction over companies like Bank of America and Citigroup, I retain advisory jurisdiction to monitor these companies and any company that received TARP assistance from the taxpayer. So if, in point of fact, I do see reoccurring abuse when it comes to compensation, I am not without some authority to try and rein in abusive pay practices.
Well, what will you do? What would your authority be and what would you do? What would be a situation that you might see? And by the way, I don't think we've really said, why don't you lay out in a very straightforward way some of the limits that you've already asked for the companies that you do still oversee, American International Group, AIG, General Motors, GMAC. Lay out some of the restrictions that you've just recently put forth.
One, sharply reduced guaranteed base cash salaries under $500,000 as a limit, and in many cases, much less than that. Two, salarized stock may be issued, but if the stock or cash, if there are going to be cash bonuses, those bonuses must be spread out over 2 years. They must be tied, as you have pointed out earlier, to objective performance metrics. And three, long-term stock may be issued, but only if these companies first repay the taxpayer. Those are the basic, succinct principles. Beyond those principles, we retain advisory authority to issue rulings which, though, although not mandatory, will have the force of Treasury behind them and hopefully will act as a deterrent to risky, excessive compensation practices. A
couple quick points about the thinking that you laid out. It was a ruling that affected the 26th through the 100th highest paid employees at each of the companies, but you also exempted about a dozen people. Just why did you do that?
I exempted 10 people from the $500,000 cap based on individual submissions to me by these companies saying that there were about 10 people where, for reasons related to competitiveness, these 10 individuals out of 450, we needed an exemption above 500 but less than $1 million.
Do you really buy that, Ken Feinberg? This is what the company's been saying all along, that in order to keep people, they have to bow to their pay demands.
I bought that argument in just 10 cases out of 450. Secondly, in some of those cases, it was not the company itself that was the only cheerleader for the notion of an exemption, but in some cases, the Federal Reserve, Treasury itself, advised me that in these particular cases, an exception was warranted. The exceptions are so few that I don't think it's anything like a trend, and they are indeed exceptional cases.
Ken Feinberg, President Obama's special master for executive pay, or president's pay czar, as everyone says. He's well aware of critics. Here's one blog, Ken. He's writing, "Your goal should not be to keep Wall Street executives working. It should be to get them to quit. Let middle management take over. A second-best scenario, their pay should be restricted, and if that makes them leave, let them go work for companies in any country stupid enough to want them. Hopefully, if not operating from the U.S., they'll be able to trash their new economy and not ours." We'll be back with more with Ken Feinberg in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Ken Feinberg, President Obama's pay czar. He's responsible for setting compensation limits on executives at Wall Street companies that took federal bailout money. Before the break, he outlined some of those limits for us. Total compensation for the top 25 executives at those companies was cut in half. Cash bonus payments were transferred into stock options that can't be sold for a period of years and have to be tied to performance. But Ken Feinberg, let's answer a question that we asked before the break. Going forward, what power do you have over companies who've paid back the bailout money? Some people have said paid back that money to get away from your compensation restrictions. What will you do if you start seeing those salaries skyrocket? And we're about to see end-of-year bonuses. It's supposed to be huge. What authority will you have?
I have statutory authority to issue a ruling with the force of the Department of the Treasury saying that these excessive compensation practices are risky and are not warranted, and that the company would be well advised to not go through with practices that are deemed risky.
Goldman Sachs also announced something else on Thursday. It, for the first time, it's going to give shareholders say in determining compensation. Now, it's a non-binding vote, but from your vantage point, this being your specialty, compensation, how important do you think it is that shareholders have a say in determining compensation? Or take another issue that's very much in the headlines now. Britain and France have both talked about, you know, huge windfall taxes on huge bonuses. Germany's taking a look at that as well, sort of the government clawing back some of this huge end-of-year bonus money. How much do you think these things would help keep American CEO and executive pay in line?
I can't speak for what Britain and France are doing, but I must say that the Secretary of the Treasury, in meeting with the G20, made it pretty clear that executive pay compensation is a subject not only for the United States, but for countries around the globe. And I find it encouraging to see that other countries, not just the United States, are using various devices to try and deal with the subject of excessive compensation. What's more important than any individual technique is, I think, a recognition on the part of government in other countries that executive pay should, in fact, be reined in and regulated somewhat.
And why is it important? A lot of Americans are angry, so for them it's punitive. You know, they want to see somebody be punished. But why, as a compensation expert, is it important to address pay? How does that address practice?
Because pay is just one example of a litany, a list of items that, when added together, are designed to curb excessive compensation, which is promoted by excessive risk in the marketplace. And it's excessive risk that, under the statute that created the Office of the Special Master, is an objective sought to be avoided. Pay should not promote excessive risk, which in turn can promote a serious downturn in the economy affecting everybody. Compensation is just one of a number of reform initiatives that, in their entirety, are designed to deal with the economic recession that we confronted in the past few years.
When you first started looking into the pay of some of these, President Obama has called them Wall Street fat cats. You told the Boston Globe at one point that you were pretty stunned. I mean, you expected there to be a gap. We all know there's a gap between what Wall Street makes and what Main Street makes. But you were stunned by not just, I think you called it a chasm, but also how people on Wall Street really didn't get it.
Well, I think that if you read the initial submissions by these companies, I think the only conclusion you could draw is that they didn't get it. But I think that as a result of the decisions we've made and the mandatory determinations that we've made, I think we've made a contribution to rectifying that balance.
Just want to ask you a couple questions. You've had other jobs having to do with compensation, and two must have been really tough. You had to work with families of victims of the 9/11 attacks and also families of victims of the Virginia Tech massacre to allocate compensation after those two events.
No comparison.
No comparison.
No comparison. No comparison. Those situations involved tragic, traumatic death, burn victims, physically injured victims, dealing with families in grief who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center, the airplanes, the Pentagon. That was an altogether different experience than this. This is a very challenging experience, but it doesn't involve the emotional outpouring of grief that we saw in 9/11 in Virginia Tech.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how much, having had those experiences, it shaped how you might approach this one. I mean, if not to put too fine a point on it, but if a CEO is whining to you about something, I'm wondering if you're thinking, "Hey, I've seen bigger problems than yours."
totally different universes. There's no comparison. I mean, no comparison in the emotion and the degree of trauma involved. I'm not saying that what I'm doing now is not an emotional exercise. There are people, don't forget, in this country, compensation is a surrogate for worth. And when you get into a discussion of what somebody is entitled to receive in compensation, you're involved in a very emotional discussion about how that individual views herself or himself in the marketplace. I understand that. But as you've pointed out, 9/11 and Virginia Tech, those involved attempts to use compensation to validate memory and worth, and much, much different.
Ken Feinberg, President Obama's special master for executive pay, or as we've been calling him, the president's pay czar. Ken, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, time for a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the BBC's Owen Bennett Jones will report for us from Yemen on al-Qaeda's growing footprint there. Also, America's past, according to historian Howard Zinn. That's all tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Normally, we deliver our next story in a straightforward manner, but given the season, we feel a need to begin with a warning that it may not be suitable for children. The issue at hand, reindeer. The problem, there are far fewer of them because, frankly, Rudolph and his friends are starving. The International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFOF, says Peary and Dolphin Union caribou, called reindeer in North America, may face extinction if not put on the endangered species list. And tomorrow, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will decide whether the government should protect them. Nathan Hirschler is the International Fund lawyer. Nathan, what are the signs that you see say there's trouble?
Peary caribou are actually one of the major bellwether species for caribou and reindeer across the circumpolar range. The total number of Peary caribou have declined from almost 50,000 individuals in the late 1960s to fewer than 8,000 today.
Well, why?
The major cause of the decline is climate change, actually. Freezing rain, as opposed to soft snow, is falling on the Arctic habitat, which the Peary and Dolphin Union caribou live, and literally encasing the land in ice, making it impossible for the caribou to reach their food sources and causing them to literally starve to death.
Well, let's stop there for just a second, because what do you say to critics who say, you know, the polar bear became the poster animal for global warming and was put on the endangered species list? But many critics feel that, in fact, polar bears are coming back, and it has to do with hunting restrictions, that, in fact, it wasn't global warming, it was overhunting. Are there other issues that are endangering reindeer?
Hunting is also a factor in the declines of Peary and Dolphin Union caribou populations. While IFAW truly does recognize the cultural and economic needs of the Inuit who utilize Peary caribou through subsistence hunting, IFAW believes that a hunting ban or a major reduction in harvest levels is actually appropriate given the dire straits of the species because of climate change.
Well, we're certainly hearing things out of Copenhagen that would back your thinking. Former Vice President Al Gore, who we know won the Nobel Peace Prize for calling attention to global warming, presented a new report with scientists in Copenhagen saying that the polar ice cap, which was projected to disappear in the summer as soon as 2030, he says may now disappear in the summer as early as 2014.
Global temperatures have already risen by two-thirds of 1 degree and may rise by as many as 6 degrees in the next century, according to the IPCC, which is the International Panel on Climate Change. The study that Al Gore, I think, is referring to is talking about the effect of black carbon and how that's going to speed up the effects of climate change that are already occurring in the Arctic.
Well, a couple questions for you. As we said, the government is deciding tomorrow whether to put these two types of reindeer on the endangered species list. Timing is coincidental, but there is, you know, both a global warming conference and Christmas. And even in your original press release back in September, you warned of, you know, not having enough reindeer for Santa's sleigh. Do you feel, you know, a little bad about sort of tugging at those heartstrings to get people to act on the reindeer?
I think that the real problem is that we have a grave threat to these two subspecies of caribou, and really that it's indicative of the overall life quality of caribou throughout their circumpolar range, and that the holiday season really provides an opportunity to make the public aware and push the United States government to do what they can to protect the species.
Well, because, you know, we do care about the reindeer. But even the Obama administration, through Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, says endangered species laws should not be a backdoor way to cut emissions. But the law clearly says it provides protection for endangered species, penalties for people that kill or injure them. But also, the law bars federal agencies from taking actions that are likely to jeopardize the species. And some would say, ipso facto, that means that the government would have to do something about cutting global emissions if, in fact, they're harming the endangered species. So are you hoping that by putting an animal like this on the endangered species list, it is a way of forcing the government to cut emissions?
We don't think that the Endangered Species Act is really the real way to go about changing climate, but we do think the United States should take a global leadership role in developing a clear way to protect our future generations and biodiversity from the effects of climate change.
Nathan Hirschler, a lawyer with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, which is trying to get two types of reindeer listed on the endangered species list. A decision will be made by the government tomorrow. Nathan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Happy holidays.
Same to you. Okay, just ahead, we're going to stay with climate change, but move to the mangrove forests of South Asia. That's in about 30 seconds, here and now. Well, we have more on the climate change summit in Copenhagen. Representatives from the European Union today called on both the U.S. and China to increase their commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Each country accuses the other of not doing its share to curb emissions. The U.S. envoy to the conference said you can't even begin to have an environmentally sound agreement without the adequate, significant participation of China. From Beijing, a spokesperson said that China continues to maintain that developed countries have the obligation to provide financial support to less wealthy nations. While they conference in Copenhagen, life is changing in some parts of the world. Recently, we brought you the story of how climate change is altering the way people live in the Sundarbans, a region along the coasts of India and Bangladesh. Today, we'll look at some other residents of the Sundarbans. The mangrove forests at the mouth of the Ganges River are home to the only man-eating tigers in the world. But scientists say this delicate ecosystem is being threatened by climate change, pushing the tigers and humans into greater contact. The BBC's South Asia correspondent Chris Morris prepared this report.
We're on a small boat heading into the heart of the Sundarbans, one of the largest mangrove forests in the world. A red sun is rising over the treetops. The water is calm. But this can be a forbidding place. We've seen deer and wild boar, monitor lizards and monkeys. There are crocodiles and sharks in these waters. But the animal everyone talks about with a mixture of fear and respect is the Royal Bengal Tiger.
Sundarbans is the all-famous mangrove tiger lands.
Niranjan Rapton has been guiding people through these swampy forests for more than 20 years.
More many times, the Sundarbans Royal Bengal Tigers.
He tells me that in every village here, people have stories to tell about tiger attacks. And the number of attacks is increasing.
And they're the only Sundarbans tiger is the man-eater, one of the world.
I come to the village of Jamespur by the water's edge. The fishermen are building a new boat here and local women are wading through the water, dredging for prawns with big nets. It all looks rather idyllic, but there's a fear haunting this village. Saber is sitting next to a small brackish pond washing her dishes. She has two little boys, aged 7 and 8, but she's had a terrible year. Back in May, her thatched roof house was destroyed by a cyclone. And 2 months later, in July, her husband Ramesh was killed in a lethal attack by a tiger.
We are all afraid of tiger. If we go to forest for earning something, we'll be the victim of tiger. Without husband, it's very difficult to live. I don't know how I will maintain my family because I don't have anything right now.
On the next island in Bijoynagar, Kohinoor Sheikh is cooking lunch, feeding a small fire as rice bubbles in a pot on a small mud stove. Her husband Ahmed was killed just a few weeks ago. He was a crab fisherman. His neighbor, Anna Ali Mullah, was with Ahmed when he died. It all happened so quickly, he says. The tiger pounced. We didn't stand a chance. Ahmed's father is also sitting listening to the conversation. He says that when he used to go out fishing years ago, there were far fewer clashes with tigers. Now, he says, the tigers even invade the villages sometimes, looking for food. It's getting worse. But it's not all bad news. In this fragile ecosystem, conservationists think they're winning the battle of hearts and minds. Colonel Shakti Banerjee of the Wildlife Protection Society of India says nearly all the deaths occur when people go into the forest, not when tigers invade the villages. He says most local people are beginning to understand that they need their local environment to survive, and that includes the tigers.
Our basic message is you save the tiger, mangrove will be saved, and mangrove will save you. People have seen these big storms whenever they come. They find the mangrove stand, whereas even the terrestrial trees, they fall.
And with no mangrove, eventually there'd be no tigers?
No mangrove, there'll be no tigers, and there'll be no human beings as well. They'll not be able to survive in this.
So a double-edged sword. The villagers here need the tigers, they need the whole ecosystem. But the tigers are also launching more and more attacks. A couple of hours' drive away at Jadavpur University in Kolkata, Professor Pranabesh Sanyal says climate change is at least in part to blame.
Climate change is causing accelerated sea level rise, and that is causing an increase in the salinity in the southern three quarters of the Sundarbans. And that is again causing the migration of the tigers from the southern islands towards the north, where the human habitation is very near. And that is why there is a man-animal conflict, and the conflict is increasing.
And that's also why some of the subjects being discussed in Copenhagen have direct and urgent relevance in places like the Sundarbans. Sailen Sarkar is the Environment Minister for the state of West Bengal.
At the time of Copenhagen conference, the West Bengal people, and particularly the inhabitants of Sundarbans, they are demand to save Sundarbans. This should be the national issue.
Back in the Sundarbans, local villagers are grinding coconut to make an offering. Suddenly, scientific and political debates seem a long way away. Madhu and Guna Mondal lost their father to a tiger 3 years ago. And every time they make for the forest, they pray to their local goddess, Bonbibi. Hindus and Muslims alike ask for the protection of the goddess. They have to work, they say, to survive. And in this vast waterscape, that often means heading into the domain of the tiger.
Have you accepted Pluto's demotion?
A tiny, barely visible speck, cold, minus 440 below. Not exactly paradise. They name the planet Pluto.
That's Christine Lavin's Planet X. Yes, they did name the ball of rock, 70%, and ice, 30%, a planet. But then in 2006, they took that title away. What to do with all the cultural references? Mickey Mouse's dog, Aaron Sorkin's late 1990s comedy, Sports Night.
We've got the Suns moving in Phoenix, hurricanes in Miami, but guess what? Pluto's still a planet.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson learned what a following Pluto had in 2001 when he was the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York and at the center of the battle over Pluto's demotion. He writes about that time and collects a wealth of information about Pluto in the book The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet, which has just been released in paperback. We spoke with Neil when the book was first published and asked him to clarify, what is Pluto?
It's a cosmic object.
Okay.
a cosmic object in the outer solar system that of late has found other icy brethren to keep it company.
And is everyone on board with this now? Because throughout the book, you tell us about an ongoing debate that you had with Mark Sykes, who, as you say, is Pluto's pit bull, you know, Pluto's biggest defender. And it seems that the last encounter was in 2008 in August when you were at a panel, and it was moderated by NPR's Ira Flatow. You entered the auditorium, the two of you, with Let's Get Ready to Rumble music, you know, big deal. But is he on board? Are the detractors of the non-planet theory all on board?
There's no one who's unsure that Pluto has family out there. That's kind of understood. A lot of the emotion was flying back and forth based on whether Pluto would retain the classification status of planet.
Right. Well, let's review the history here. Clyde Tombaugh discovered planet X in 30. It was named Pluto after the god of the underworld. But it always had some unusual characteristics, as you said, that sort of had scientists questioning it. Why? What were those?
Oh, yeah, the characteristics are manifest. First, its orbit is so odd that it crosses the orbit of another planet. It crosses the orbit of Neptune. No other planet does that. You announced at the beginning of this broadcast that it's 70% rock. However, if you look at the volume, because rock is heavier than ice, it's more than half ice by volume. An object like that, if you brought it, for example, to where Earth is, the sunlight would evaporate that ice and it would grow a tail.
Hmm. Now, and be a comet.
That's no kind of behavior for a planet. And we got words for things with tails. And not only that, its orbit is tipped heavily out of the plane of the rest of the orbits of the planets. And so it's an oddball, no matter how you slice it.
All right. Well, you were appointed head of the Hayden Planetarium and also appointed project scientist for the Rose Center for Earth and Space. And one of the big questions people there were grappling with was how to classify planets. So you pulled together a conference on Pluto's planethood. Some of these questions were expressed. It was determined that Pluto was an object in the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah. There's a guy, Gerard Kuiper, at mid-20th century, who hypothesized that there'd be this reservoir of icy bodies in the outer solar system left over from the formation of the solar system. And Pluto, turns out, is a prominent member of the Kuiper
right.
Belt.
So that's the family that it's now in. And the planetarium goes ahead and puts together an exhibit classifying Pluto with, you know, other objects like it, not with the planets. And everything is fine until the New York Times reporter is visiting and overhears a child ask, "Where's Pluto?"
The reporter who overheard this figured he had, like, a real scoop. He contacted the science reporter, who returned and actually wrote the story, which hit page one of the New York Times.
We all remember.
Page one.
And Neil, you are accused of eliminating Pluto. It's front page news. There's stories everywhere. Now, we're reminded, you said, you know, one of the problems with categorizing Pluto as a planet is that you'd have to consider other objects' planets as well, including Pluto's moon, Charon, and Ceres. And you end up on the Stephen Colbert show. This is how crazy this is getting. And poke fun at that. Let's listen.
Hey, Charon, your orbit is so big you only get Christmas once every 248 years. Even then, all you get is earmuffs because it's so cold. Snap! All right, we got Ceres. Let's go to Ceres right here. Tell me about Ceres.
That's object formerly known as an asteroid. Mm-hmm. It happens to be big enough so that its gravity tucked it into a nice round shape.
All right, have a good look. I got it. Hey, Ceres, guess what? They call you a planet, but we both know you're just a fat-ass steroid. Yeah, you're so ugly, God tried to hide you in an asteroid belt.
Neil, you're a serious scientist. do you believe the wild ride you went on?
It was extraordinary. One could be disturbed by it, but another outlook of it would be to celebrate the fact that there was a scientific controversy that so thoroughly engaged the public. Kids and journalists and old people and young people, and everyone chose sides. It's as though everyone had some investment in the answer to that question.
Well, legislatures in New Mexico and California proposed declaring Pluto to still be a planet. And you know, people really did care. You got a lot of hate mail.
One of my favorites is, "Dear Dr. Tyson, you took out my favorite planet. Please put it back. Here's a drawing of it." And there it is in crayon. It says, "Write back soon, but not in cursive. I can't read cursive yet."
That same child writes, "If you make Pluto a planet again, the science books will be right."
That's right.
But if you say it's not a planet, what if people live there? They won't exist. Hey, a point.
Yeah, people are over-assessing the actual power we have over the cosmos.
But it did get very heated. I mentioned Mark Sykes. They had some very heated conversations with, you know, people within the science community who were very upset about this. Why the passion?
Right. So it wasn't just the public or the school kids. There was the professional community as well, many of whom studied Pluto as a cosmic object felt very strongly that Pluto should retain planet status. I had no investment one way or another, but I can tell you this, that in the end, I really don't care how you define the word planet. I just know that if the way you define it includes huge bulbous, gaseous planets with small, dense ones, that if Pluto is in the same class as Jupiter, and the word planet is the word you're using, then the word planet has kind of lost most of its utility.
Well, Pluto is still there and may be there well beyond us.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's not that anything changed about Pluto. It's something changed about our understanding of the structure of the solar system. And so while I was sort of the most visible exponent of this movement from 2000 on through 2006, in 2006, the professional community brought it to vote and basically agreed with our sentiment. And so Pluto gets demoted. So now there are only 8 planets, and Pluto is now the benchmark class of a new kind of object called Plutoids. And so that's fine. I don't have a problem with these definitions.
Well, just take a quick look ahead for us. You know, I want to ask you what you think we don't know. You know, what else do you think? I mean, do you see something on the horizon, literally, that might change the way we think about something?
Well, about Pluto, I can tell you that there's a mission en route to Pluto right now, and it's going to swing by Pluto and look at other objects in the Kuiper Belt. What that will do is bring a whole new understanding of the properties of objects that are out there. It's a new swath of real estate, sort of born in the 1990s into our awareness as we started discovering these other icy bodies in the outer solar system. So when I think of the Pluto story, I don't think of it as we lost a planet. We gained a whole new place in the solar system. People should embrace that kind of discovery.
They invented a reason, and that's why it stings. They don't think you matter because you don't have...